A new study out this week says the world is poised to give up fossil fuels altogether by the year 2050. This hour, how one Catholic church in Norwalk is getting into the spirit of solar. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also included in today's quick conversations, Apple's plans to plant 2 data centers in Waukee for over $1 billion, a final plea to keep Iowa's struggling ACA marketplace afloat, One Iowa condemns the new transgender military ban, and we meet one of the 35 riders from 34 countries who've just taken up residency here in Iowa. Buckle up for your NewsBuzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's start this NewsBuzz Friday with energy and the environment. A report commissioned by Energy Secretary Rick Perry acknowledges that low natural gas prices, it's not renewables, that are behind the recent closure of coal energy plants, and that the grid has managed to withstand the increasing presence of renewable energy. Also, according to another unrelated study published this week, this one in the journal Joule, the world is poised to give up fossil fuels altogether. According to this analysis, the planet is pretty much ready to go, 100% renewable by the year 2050. Well, leaders from various faith traditions across our state are getting into the spirit of solar power and other renewables, not only in an effort to aid the environment, also to save money. St. John the Apostle Catholic Church in Norwalk is a good case in point. Joining us from that parish in our Des Moines studio, Father John Ludwig, and also Terry Dvorak. He's a parishioner and a CEO of Redline Renewables. That's a solar development firm. Father Ludwig and Terry Dvorak, welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Let's talk about how you have lessened the carbon footprint of your church. I understand more than 200 solar panels there, Father Ludwig?
That's correct.
Yeah, we've put 206 340-watt panels of solar up on our building after we've done our LED light changes. So we did the low-hanging fruit, reduced our carbon footprint first, and then we looked at renewable energy and was able to do it in a pretty unique way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what does that look like from the outside?
Well, of course, without in radio, it's hard to describe that, but we have a large pitched roof on the southwest side of our church, and so the panels fit very nicely on that section of the building. And then also in the flat roof areas on that same side, which are invisible from the ground, another set of solar panels. So it isn't it's not an eyesore by any means.
Mm-hmm. Terry, tell us, because you are our technology guy in solar energy, how does this work? What happens to the solar energy? It hits those panels, and then what?
That's right. Solar absorbs the light that comes off of the sun, the free energy we've got, and it converts it into a usable form, and it goes right back into the building. And if we're not using it in the building at the time it's produced, we simply push it back out on the grid, and the houses next door use it, or somebody else down the street uses it.
Mm-hmm. Father Ludwig, I understand this was inspired, at least in part, by the Holy Father's campaign.
Well, that's correct. As you mentioned at the beginning, there's the cost savings, which is also an important thing. But Pope Francis has been very, very clear on the importance of taking care of the earth, taking care of our common home. And air pollution and, burning of fossil fuels is one way that we've messed that up. And the solar and geothermal and things like that, wind energy, those are ways that we can begin to abate that.
Mm-hmm. Is that, Father Ludwig, is that something you deliver sermons on? Do you talk often about climate change, the need to take care of the planet?
Not so much in sermons, although occasionally that comes up, but mostly in parish meetings. We're talking to our finance council and our pastoral council about the possibility of doing this and helping to clean up the environment and at the same time save some money by doing that.
How much investment these days, because the solar energy sector has been growing so rapidly and costs have been coming down, Terry, what do you have to think of when you think of the investment, and then at the point you'll return on that investment and start actually, doing great things for your bottom line?
Well, it depends. I mean, for homeowners and for businesses, the paybacks are pretty good, and depends on how much you're paying for electricity. I mean, solar doesn't offset everything. It offsets kilowatt hours, and the right way to go about it is important. At the church, I mean, we've got a way that it didn't cost the church any money up front, which means the savings that we had on our electricity bill was immediate.
Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
Well, it happened because we had some parishioners and non-parishioners who helped invest in it and actually own the system, and they get tax credits, which the church can't get. And we indirectly get them to the church through our lease arrangement, and that, you know, it's a win-win all the way around. Our tax credit investors get tax credits instead of paying the IRS their money. They're paying it to a solar project. They can see their tax dollars go to good use. They get credit. And then we pass the savings along to the church, who gets a lower rate for the electricity. It's a win all the way around.
Terry, you're a parishioner at the church, but also the CEO of Redline Renewables. How did you get started in the renewable energy sector?
Well, I got started. I've been in it for about 8 years, and it kind of solidified itself when I made the trip to China. And if anybody's been overseas in a very we've all seen like L.A. and Chicago and Denver where they've got smog and stuff. But China's a different boat. If you watch the 2010 Olympics, you kind of saw the blurbs on, kids wearing masks and stuff from the particulates. And that's true. I mean, I can still taste that acrid air from back in 2010 when I saw that. And with little kids myself, it's our part. And we've got to do our part to make it happen, to reduce our environmental footprint. I mean, you wouldn't go home and plug the tailpipe of your car and pump it into your house and fill it up and think that's right. Well, that's what we do with our environments. We only got one planet. And so at that point, it was like, okay, how do I get this to work in Iowa? Because I'm an Iowa farm boy. How do I get it to work for churches and schools and cities to where we can do it in a financially responsible manner and make a difference? And that's what we've done.
Now, as you mentioned, the Pope has been an inspiration to this move. Is this something he learns about through the hierarchy of the church?
Well, he's 80 years old, I think, and so he's had lots and lots of experience. He was in Buenos Aires. He was a Jesuit priest to begin with, so he's been a lot of places and consulted with a lot of people. So it's caring for the earth isn't really a new idea, but it's certainly gotten more popular. And he's brought it in to the religious sphere by saying this is something we need to do for ourselves and for those who follow us.
Mm-hmm. You hope this will be an inspiration, or perhaps you've already received some feedback for other churches, other buildings.
Interestingly enough, the other churches in Norwalk have expressed an interest. When they discovered how we were able to do this project, they said, gosh, we'd be interested in that as well. And so they're in the process of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Back to earthly finances, just how much money will you be saving in the coming years?
I can let Terry answer that when he's got a little better sense of it.
The St. John's going to save about $2,000 a year is what our projection is, and that's only offsetting 40% of our electricity use. I mean, we were limited by the amount of roof space because we've got some other future expansion, and that was important when we designed it too. Let's keep the future in mind because it's going to be there for 30-plus years, and we didn't want to short-tail ourselves on future expansions and what's going to happen. So we've been approached by a lot of other, we're helping other schools and cities and churches across the state, which is what we want to do, and, help the environment, help their finances. I mean, the other cool thing is that $2,000 that we save at our parish, I mean, we can use that for doing better missionary things. I mean, we do Habitat for Humanity, we do Meals for the Heartland, some other charitable organizations. And when you take a school, I've got some schools we're working on down in Pekin, saving $12,000 a year, that's half a teacher salary. You take the city of Lisbon that we're helping out, $7,000 a year for a city of 1,500 people, that pays for some parks and rec. I mean, it's these things that it's we now have a way to go solar, be green, be environmental stewardships, without having it to be a monetary investment for the customer. You know, I'd love to challenge every corporation and every accredited investor out there that makes, you know, more than $200,000 to do their part and look at us and help their school and church and city and small town and fire department, library, and all that, so that we can make a significant difference. And that's the only limitation we have, is getting more people involved.
Terry, perhaps you can leave us with a big picture view of the future. At the outset, I mentioned this study published this week in the journal Jewel. I have no idea if you've had a chance to look at that, where it's very possible that 139 countries, I think, in this study, could give up fossil fuels altogether with the right guidance. The planet would be pretty much ready to go 100% renewable by 2050. Does that, as someone working in solar development, does that study surprise you, or do you see that's perfectly feasible?
I've been watching it for a while, and one of the keys to make that goal a reality, it's a holistic approach. So it's not that we're going to wean ourselves from fossil fuels tomorrow. One of the biggest exciting things is battery storage, and that's been the missing link, and it is now getting feasible. And in fact, if others want to help us, we're going to try and do a demonstration project with a college in Iowa, where we'll put in battery storage, and that will demonstrate that, yes, renewables can take on that role. And by 2050, I think we could get to 100% if we really wanted to.
Iowa, of course, well known for wind energy, a leader in the country in wind energy, but we have a lot of solar power that can still be taken advantage of when we compare to other states, right, Terry?
We do, actually. In Iowa, we have more solar potential in Iowa than the state of Florida.
Really?
People won't realize that, but if you think about it in mind, Florida, you know, they get their afternoon, well, maybe not lately, but afternoon rain shower, where we don't. We have as much solar in Iowa as the leading solar generating country in the world, which is Germany. So we have plenty here. We are blessed with wind. You know, we're right on the edge of the Saudi Arabia of wind, so to speak. But when you pair those two and then we throw battery storage, it really makes Iowa an exciting place. And if we have more investors that want to help that cause, can use tax credits to help their schools and churches help this move it along, we can make Iowa a very renewable state.
Terry Dvorak is a parishioner at St. John the Apostle Catholic Church in Norwalk, also CEO and of Redline Renewables, a solar development firm, and of course, joining him, Father John Ludwig of St. John the Apostle Church in Norwalk. Gentlemen, thank you for both coming in and exploring this exciting new venture in solar energy that you're doing there in Norwalk.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Big news from Apple this week for Iowa. We heard that. Apple Inc. Plans to spend $1.375 billion, nearly $1.4 billion to build two state-of-the-art data centers in Waukee. State and local officials are putting more than $213 million in incentives towards the plan. Joining me now to discuss this a bit is Kevin Hardy, business, labor, and economy reporter for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So tell us exactly, what are these data centers that will be appearing, being built in Waukee?
Well, these things are essentially the backbones of these tech companies, where they process their data and store their data. And they're essentially the kind of behind-the-scenes operation of things that we do on our phones and computers every day. So for Apple in particular, they say, you know, these new data centers will help support things like iMessage, Siri, and its App Store and other Apple services for North American customers. That's what they have said, you know, this data center in particular will do.
Mm-hmm. And if we would walk into one of these huge facilities, from what I've seen of pictures, I don't know if you've been in one, Kevin, but they're just rows and rows of servers, right? Super cooled.
Right. Yeah, more machines than people. They're, you know, generally windowless kind of hulking entities there that you might not know what they are from the outside. But yes, rows and rows of servers and wires, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm. Give us an idea, Kevin, of what this means for Waukee and for the state of Iowa. Who benefits especially here?
I think there's some question as to what the tangible benefits will be. Obviously, there are 50 immediate permanent jobs that will be associated with this plant. The governor and other economic development officials have touted, you know, the 550 or so expected construction jobs that will come along with this project. But and there's also an opportunity that this land, now that the city of Waukee is going to provide some, you know, city services like water and sewer there, that it might spur more development out there. And this is newly annexed land that was previously between Waukee and Adel. So there's a potential for more development. And kind of on a broader scheme, Governor Kim Reynolds yesterday touted kind of the optics of having a company like Apple coming to Iowa, which is, you know, the world's most profitable company and one of the most ubiquitous tech firms, you know, in the world.
Mm-hmm. Is there any question that this, what Iowa did to lure this in, $213 million in incentives, any question that that's worth it for this big of a facility?
You're definitely seeing some question from Democrats, and even some Republicans have questioned whether that was a good investment. The Republican Pat Grassley, chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, you know, tweeted yesterday that he wasn't convinced that that was a good deal for Apple or for Iowa taxpayers. It's also one of the most expensive deals for data centers in the country, according to this group, Good Jobs First, that tracks these kinds of projects. On a per jobs basis, this was the second most expensive use of taxpayer incentives for a data center, according to Good Jobs First.
Mm-hmm. Past those tax incentives, what does Apple find attractive about Iowa?
You know, CEO Tim Cook said the first and foremost thing is the access to renewable energy. As you know, Iowa is a wind energy leader, and that was important for Iowa. For Apple, they want to see all their data centers running on 100% renewable energy, and Iowa's portfolio of wind helps them get there. They also mentioned Governor Kim Reynolds and her commitment and kind of expertise in STEM fields and technology as being important to Apple. And from what we hear from other tech companies, some other factors that make data centers that bring data centers here includes, you know, the big availability of land that we have with farm fields everywhere, and low energy costs and the relatively low risk of natural disasters. So that makes Iowa a better place than most for data centers.
Mm-hmm. From your perspective, it wouldn't be surprising to have more data centers pop up in the future?
Oh, not at all. And I think even with this project, you'll see this is a 400,000 square foot project, but Apple has access to 2,000 acres in Waukee. So they've already talked about plans for expansion, and that's what we've seen with Google, Facebook, and Microsoft, that once they establish roots, they continue to expand those operations.
Kevin Hardy of the Des Moines Register, thanks for giving us an update.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Well, we heard this week, if you got this Wall Street Journal article, had a look at that, the White House is expected to submit direction to the Pentagon on how to implement a ban on transgender people in the U.S. military in the coming days. Remember, back at the end of last month, the end of July, President Trump announced the upcoming ban in a series of tweets, but then at that time provided no official policy guidance until this point. The memo described in the Wall Street Journal midweek evidently directs the Pentagon to deny transgender individuals admittance in the military and to stop spending on medical treatment for transgender people currently serving. That's according to U.S. officials cited in this Wall Street Journal article. It also indicates that transgender members currently serving would be subject to removal at Defense Secretary James Mattis's discretion based on what was described as their deployability. Here's what the president said this week when asked if he was betraying a community that he pledged to support during the campaign.
No, look, I have great respect for the community. I think I have great support, or I've had great support from that community. I got a lot of votes. But the transgender, the military is working on it now. They're doing the work. It's been a very difficult situation. And I think I'm doing a lot of people a favor by coming out and just saying it. As you know, it's been a very complicated issue for the military. It's been a very confusing issue for the military. And I think I'm doing the military a great favor.
Donald Trump a few days ago speaking about the transgender military ban. Joining me now, Daniel Hoffman Zinnel, Executive Director of One Iowa. One Iowa, the state's leading lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender organization. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Ben.
We just heard that quote by the president this week, complicated, difficult, confusing for the military. He believes he's doing the military a favor. What's your reaction?
Well, you know, we feel like transgender individuals have been serving in the military since probably the existence of the military, and it's just another way for the White House to target a specific group of individuals, and we're seeing it as a form of discrimination.
Mm-hmm. So what's behind these words, though? We had, you know, the direction there to stop spending on medical treatment for transgender people. Specifics, when the president says difficult for the military, confusing, what specifics have you seen put behind this reasoning?
Well, we haven't heard specifically from the military themselves about their experiences of working with trans folks. We do work with a variety of different individuals that are currently serving and have heard their experiences. But specifically, he's calling for banning individuals from joining. And then the deployability component with Defense Secretary Mattis is still a little bit unclear as to whether how that's going to be implemented. But essentially has 6 months to implement from when the memo comes out, and we're expecting that in the next few days.
Disruption is another word that the president has used in his reasoning here. What is the reasoning, the disruption that the president sees here in the military? Do you follow any of that?
I think there's some false claims regarding some of the reasoning for this, specifically related to the medical component. Their ability to go into employment with specific medical conditions. But many individuals who are trans are able to manage their medical component very easily, just as many diabetics are able to do that when they're in the military and able to serve. And there's a variety of different folks or different forms of hormone replacement therapy that individuals can elect to use, but not all transgender individuals do use hormone replacement therapy or elect to have surgery. And mm-hmm. So there's another complex component to all of this.
How many transgender Iowans who are members of the military have you heard from since this transgender ban was announced last month by the president?
We've heard from a handful, and we have many here locally that have been part of news channel outlets. Jack Schuler's been interviewed locally here in Des Moines. So there's quite a few in Iowa and across the country. There's a very large percentage of transgender individuals that either have served in the military or are currently serving. It is the highest percentage of individuals, if you break it out by demographic, that serve in the military.
Mm-hmm. How are Iowa's members of Congress reacting to this from what you hear?
Well, when the first tweet came out, we applauded Senator Joni Ernst for disagreeing with Trump on the specific ban. She went a little further with wanting to keep the medical piece to what Trump had said into that. And so we applauded Senator Ernst for differing on Trump's tweet that he released.
Okay. We have just a few seconds left. What's your sense of how this will play out, what you're working for at least?
Well, we know there's already lawsuits that have been filed by Lambda Legal, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and GLAAD, and so we anticipate there would be a potential court case if this were to come to fruition.
Okay. In a few seconds, so your message directly to the president, were he to be listening right now.
Focus his efforts on things rather than focusing on individuals that are discriminatory, and get to know folks who are transgender. We see a lot of rhetoric that's dehumanizing, and I feel like if we got folks that identified as transgender in front of them, that oftentimes people are able to change their hearts and minds. There was a study done.
Okay, we've got to go. We'll leave it there. Daniel Hoffman-Zinnel, Executive Director of One Iowa. Thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Ben.
When we come back, we continue with this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up a little bit later in the program, we'll meet one of the 35 riders from 34 countries who've just taken up residency here in Iowa as part of the International Writing Program. But first, this week, Iowa's Insurance Commissioner Doug Ohman said that if the federal government doesn't take any action, About 20,000 Iowans likely will not be able to afford insurance through the Affordable Care Act market in 2018. Commissioner Doug Omen submitted the state's final plea to the federal government. He's asking for permission to make changes he believes will keep Iowa's struggling Affordable Care Act marketplace afloat. Here to explain, as we do so often, have him in, Pete Damiano, director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, professor in the University of Iowa Department of Preventive and Community Dentistry. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you, Ben.
Explain a little bit more about the backdrop here, the situation that Obamacare finds itself in 7 months into the Trump presidency, also considering the backdrop of a Republican-controlled Congress that vowed and tried and has thus far failed to repeal and replace the ACA.
Correct. And so now we're left with, what do we do where there are some issues related to the ACA? I think almost everyone across the board would admit the ACA is not perfect. Even the day it was passed, it was sort of this Senate version, never went back to the House to adjust it in the way that many people thought. And now we're left with certain pieces of it that need some adjusting. And one of those, and even though this is sort of all under this banner of Obamacare, this is really the individual insurance market component. So this is the relatively small portion of the population. It's still important if you need to buy this, but it's those people that don't get it through their employer, don't get it through a public program, don't get it through the VA, military, whatever, and go out and actually buy a policy. And so that's where Wellmark has said they're no longer going to offer any individual policies in the state. Coventry also pulled out. And so we're left with only one insurance company in the state that's statewide, and that's a company called Medica out of the Twin Cities. And they have said that because of everyone else coming out and the uncertainty, because the Trump administration has not said whether they're going to keep all of the subsidies in place for people that purchase this private insurance, that their rates are, they're estimating to go up an average of 57%.
Mm-hmm.
So for some people, it could literally double the cost of their premium, especially if they're coming from some of the plans like Coventry, they had said for certain people it could double.
So enter the proposal by Iowa's Insurance Commissioner, Doug Omen. What does he want to do? This is a stopgap measure he's suggesting.
Right. This is many would say a better than nothing. He would even, from what he has said, not a perfect plan, but it's what can we do as a proposal to deal with this in the short term. So there's a number of reasons that the individual market, but basically we're not getting enough younger, healthy people in. There hasn't been as much of a loss of employer-based insurance as people have thought. There are these what are called grandmothered and grandfather plans, some of which have been extended further. So you don't have as many people in. And in Iowa, for a variety of reasons, but a lot of that we haven't been marketing at all, we've had the smallest proportion of people who are marketplace eligible purchasing it. So what this plan would do is it's a waiver that they're asking the federal government under this innovation waiver part of the Affordable Care Act, that they're asking to take all of the money, and it's about $250 million that would have gone into subsidies for people who were purchasing the insurance. And there's a subsidy, and this is the part that's unclear whether the Trump administration will continue it. There's been a House lawsuit over this for a number of years about lower income people, 100 to 250% of poverty, were getting help with their deductibles and copayments. So they're going to take all of that money and propose and have proposed this new plan that has basically three parts to it. The first is that there's a single standardized plan that whoever number of carriers that would decide to go along with this, it's also not clear how much time there is and whether others will come in, but they will have a single subsidized plan that consumers will be able to get. To be able to do that, they're going to change the subsidy and do it on a flat per member per month mm-hmm. approach instead of a graduated income approach up to 400%. And even some people over 400% of poverty can be eligible, and then reinsure the insurance companies.
A lot of detail here, Peter. I'm afraid we've got just a minute or two left here. Have any indications how the federal government will react here? Will it grant this proposal?
Well, according to Commissioner Omen, they've been in back and forth conversation for months. This was originally proposed back in June. So you'd hope at this point that with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, They're the ones who would have to approve this waiver that they've had of that ongoing conversation to the point that this adjustment, this final plan going in, the concerns would be worked out, but you just never know till it's approved.
Mm-hmm. And if the federal government doesn't approve this proposal, I mentioned that 20,000 Iowan figure at the outset, what happens?
Right. Then those people would either not be eligible for a subsidy at all, those ones over 400% of poverty, or they're going to have to buy a much more expensive plan than would have been there otherwise, and whether they're going to be able to afford to do that or not. Even with this, the insurance commissioner has estimated that there'll be about 4,000 or 5,000 people who still will not have coverage that did have it before because of some of those issues.
When are we likely to find out whether this final plea will be answered? Doug Oman's plea will be answered?
There's no indication from the insurance commissioner or others that I have seen in terms of a date on when you're going to hear. From our experience working with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services on our evaluation work of federal, you just never know how long that process will take.
Okay, Pete Damiano, director of the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, thanks for explaining the latest update on the Affordable Care Act.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, PBS unveiled a new TV special about the historic Voyager space missions featuring University of Iowa scientist Don Gurnett. The probes Gurnett helped design for Voyager 1 signaled that the spacecraft had breached our solar system's heliosphere and, in doing so, became the first man-made object in interstellar space. The PBS program is called The Farthest. It marks the 40th anniversary of the launch of the Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft. The missions are historic because they were the first to explore the outer planets, planets like Uranus and Neptune. And Voyager 1 has now flown further than anything produced by humankind, and it's still going. You can view the special at pbs.org or just Google PBS The Farthest. It will air September 13th on IPTV. Well, in recognition of Gurnett's work and this new special, we thought we'd air part of a conversation I recorded with Don Gurnett back in 2012. Take a listen. Voyager 1 carries with it a golden record filled with images, music, and sounds of our planet. Greetings like these.
Hello from the children of planet Earth.
Bonjour tout le monde.
Hola y saludos a todos.
Herzliche Grüße an alle.
Konnichiwa, o genki desu ka?
And sounds like these from Earth.
Oh, come on now.
I think you recognized all of those. Also, music like this. For you, Don Gurnett, as a scientist working on this project for more than three decades, what are the big lessons for you?
Oh, I'll have to tell you, Voyager was just a tremendous mission. I mean, I just feel privileged to have been involved in it. What you have to think about is that, for example, there are these four large satellites at Jupiter called the Galilean satellites. He discovered those satellites in the famous year 1610. And ever since then, even with our best telescopes at Earth, all you could say is they were just dots of light. I mean, you really can't resolve them. And in March of 1979, I remember all this vividly, we flew by Jupiter, went by some of these moons, and just, you know, overnight, in a matter of hours, we close in on a moon like Io, and you get these pictures, just tremendous pictures. Io looked like a pizza. In fact, it was joked at the time that we had the pizza model of Io. And over 400 years since Galileo, we knew nothing almost about these moons. And now we know that Io, for example, is the most the black dots on it, those are volcanoes. It's the most volcanic object in the solar system. Another huge moon called Ganymede that is a huge essentially a ball of water ice, almost as big as the planet Mercury. And then we go out to Saturn, and we fly by Saturn, and we go by this moon, Titan, which is the one that Carl Sagan wanted to visit. And the reason we wanted to go there was that Titan, we knew, had an atmosphere. They could detect methane. Then again, in just a matter of a few hours, we close in and fly by Titan. And just an incredible place, actually. Mm-hmm. It has a nitrogen atmosphere. It's the only object in the solar system other than Earth that has a dense nitrogen atmosphere. It has an atmosphere of pressure 1.5 times the Earth's atmosphere. But more startling than that, they discovered that the atmosphere is just full of hydrocarbons. It's very cold. It's almost minus 400 Fahrenheit. And you could see these layers in the atmosphere, kind of haze layers, that were different hydrocarbons. Like,
what is the significance of hydrocarbons?
Why? Origin of life. It means that these hydrocarbons were there probably in the formation of the solar system. You can see ethane, propane, acetylene, hydrogen cyanide, just a whole spectrum of these things.
University of Iowa scientist Don Gurnett. It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's been called the United Nations of Writing. Since its founding in 1967, over 1,400 writers from more than 150 countries have come to Iowa to enjoy a residency at the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. This week, 35 writers from 34 countries have found their way to Iowa City to start a 12-week writer's residency. And on Monday night, I had the good fortune to attend a welcoming party for them. I had a chance to talk with, about a half dozen of them briefly. And we'll be hearing those conversations each Friday, one each Friday in the coming weeks, starting today. In just a moment, we'll meet one of the writers, a Somali-Italian novelist and social activist. But first, to learn about the origins and the mission of the International Writing Program, I spoke Monday with its director. Okay, I'm talking with Christopher Merrill. He's the director of the International Writing Program for nearly 20 years, right?
This is my 18th residency, yes, since 2000.
And it's a momentous year because this is the 50th year of the International Writing Program, started way back in 1967. Tell us, how did the IWP get started?
Well, it grew out of the writer's workshop. Paul and Walling Engel decided that they wanted to create a workshop for international writers. Paul thought it was the craziest idea he'd ever heard, and Walling helped him to make that idea come to life. And now here we are 50 years later, having hosted over 1,400 writers from nearly 150 countries, including two Nobel laureates. It's a pretty amazing run that we've had.
I just talked to a Slovenian writer that you have here this year. He said Iowa is a well-known quantity in Slovenia, especially in writing circles, because of the IWP. So it's hard to encapsulate, but I'm going to challenge you to do this in the 50 years that the IWP has been around. What has it achieved? What are its biggest achievements for Iowa and for the United States?
Well, it's one reason why Iowa City became a UNESCO City of Literature, because we took that Iowa model, a place where here in the middle of the Midwest, writers would gather to create new work, to critique their work, to expand their aesthetic horizons, and we took it worldwide. And so, to speak of Slovenia, for example, there was a young Slovenian poet here in the early 1970s named Tomas Šalamon, translated by a couple of students from the writer's workshop. He became one of the most influential poets for young American poets in the 1990s and the 2000s. That's because literature works by subterranean means, that it influences us in different ways, and so we've had the chance here in Iowa City to be influenced and shaped by writers from literally every country and every continent.
How are these writers selected?
Well, the majority of the writers come to us through embassies and consulates, through the U.S. State Department, and we look for writers in early to mid-career who have already achieved national prominence, if not international prominence. And then we look to try to get as diverse a group of writers as possible. So this year we have poets and playwrights and fiction writers and essayists and filmmakers, a librettist, an opera singer, a doctor. They do all sorts of different things. And so they bring to the table an amazing range of skills and gifts, and they open up the world for us.
We will be meeting many of this year's residency writers in the coming weeks on River to River. But let me ask you, what are they seeking? What do they want?
Well, I say to the writers on the first day that their first priority here is to write. I hope that they will create a lot of new works while they're here. I also want them to come away with new impressions of this country and of the writers they meet during their stay here. Mostly, I want them to feel that they are in a place where literature counts, and that's what Iowa City is all about. So we make them available to the public. If you go to our website, iwp.uiowa.edu, you'll see that there will be probably 200 public events, all free, all open to the public, where you have the chance to hear a writer from Venezuela speaking with a writer from Guyana, speaking with a Chinese writer, a writer from Hong Kong, from Argentina, from Kazakhstan. It's a short course in the history of the world available here at the IWP.
And finally, because this is a program that focuses mainly on news around the nation, in Iowa, around the world, for discussion, what relevancy does this program, the writers you have from around the world, have to the events in 2017, what we're going through as a nation?
Well, I think one thing will be interesting to hear what the writers make of this country at this moment. Historically, writers have come to this country. Think of de Tocqueville, who wrote the wonderful book on democracy in 1848. Writers come here and they have a fresh angle of vision on who and what we're all about. And so I imagine that given the complexities of this moment in history, given the political divisions in this country, we've got 35 writers who will be looking at that, examining it, writing about it, bearing witness to it, taking that news back to their countries, giving the world a slightly more nuanced view of the United States. Writers work against stereotypes. That's what they do. And a lot of writers come here with stereotypes about this country right now, given Charlottesville, given all the divisions that we have. And I suspect that after 3 months of daily interactions with Iowans and writers from around the world, they will have a more complex view of our time here. That's the essence of cultural diplomacy, which we define as the exchange of ideas and information. What better way to do it than through literature?
Poet, essayist, writer Christopher Merrill, also director of the International Writing Program, thank you for your time, and good luck with this handful of 30, how many writers?
35 writers from 34 countries.
35 writers from 34 countries over the next 12 weeks here in Iowa and in the Midwest. You've got your hands full, but you've got your hands full of a lot of valuables.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Ben.
And as I mentioned, over the next several weeks on News Buzz Friday, we'll be getting to know a few of the 35 writers from 34 countries this year who've come to Iowa for the IWP's fall residency. This week, our first one, let's meet a Somali-Italian novelist, performer, teacher, and social activist.
So my name is Ubah Christina Ali Farah, and I'm Somali-Italian. I was born in Verona in the northern Italy, and of a Somali father and Italian mother. And when I was 2, my parents moved to Somalia because it was I was born at the beginning of the 70s. So my father went to Italy to study, and then he wanted to go back to Somalia because the 70s were the years just after independence. So many African students wanted to go back to the country and somehow contribute to the development and to the history also of the country.
So with your Somali and your Italian background, what are you drawn to in your writing? What do you write about?
I mostly, because I grew up in Somalia and I was forced to leave the country in 1991 when the civil war started. My first novels were mostly about the diaspora, the civil war, and also the connections between Italy and Somalia that have been very often neglected in the Italian history. I mean, Italians don't recognize the past history, the connection with Somalia, mainly because it was connected with the history of fascist history, the fascist legacy, and so they tend to deny it. So
You come to the United States in 2017 in a very interesting time for Americans, and also I imagine for those visiting the United States. How are you reacting to all of this and the times that we live in? Let me just say it that way.
I think that we are living in a very difficult time, and I think that somehow art and literature and all forms of art are important, because it's very difficult to get to know history or a culture, or and the best way to get to know something is through the personal history of the people, and because you have this kind of intimate connection, and that facilitates somehow the knowledge.
Well, thank you very much for this short conversation. I wish you the best. Enjoy your time in Iowa here as part of the International Writing Program's residency.
Thank you so much.
And that just about brings this NewsBuzz edition of River to River to a close. One note before I go. Next week on this program, next Thursday, over the noon hour, Senator Bernie Sanders is scheduled to join us for the hour live. So send your questions now that you'd like to have me ask Senator Bernie Sanders. You can send those to this email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.